been following your lead, we got nothing but trouble.
You have eluded me
for the last time.
I got the answers. I'm bona fide.
Maybe your friends think I'm just a stranger. My face you know.
George Clooney, John Turturro, Holly Hunter, and John Goodman star in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Audio Describe. Sunday afternoon at 1 on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Sunday Movie Matinee.
You ever been with a woman? I gotta get the family farm back before I can start thinking about that.
The Midland Lighthouse for the Blind is currently hiring a production worker. Job summary: responsible for a variety of hand assembly production of writing instruments, safety and security items as directed by manufacturing manager or working foreman. Job functions and responsibilities: assemble writing instruments, package finished items that have been assembled. Additional responsibilities, if applicable: read work orders and pull the needed components from stock. Other duties will be assigned by supervisor. Qualifications: must be able to function in a team environment, and good work ethic. These positions are for legally blind and blind individuals. Individuals are defined as legally blind if central visual acuity does not exceed 20/200 in the better eye with correcting lenses. Alternatively, if visual acuity is better than 20/200, then field of vision in the better eye is limited to a degree that its widest diameter subtends an angle of no greater than 20 degrees. Benefits that are offered: health insurance, dental insurance, life insurance, retirement plan, NASA insurance, vacation and sick pay, profit sharing, tuition reimbursement, advancement opportunities. And for more information, you can call 325-653-4231 or visit 211 South Lee Street in Midland, Texas, or call the Recording Library at 432-682-2731.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 44 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-30s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Greetings, folks. This is Monica Hatch from Mind's Eye Radio, and we're going to continue with the travelogue program. We were toward the tail end of the article entitled High Drama about On the Trail of Two Tudor Women, Headstrong Queen and Enterprising Countess. Nina Kaplan was exploring England's Peak District, where the rugged landscapes become portal to the past. We left off when she had been talking about giving up her cycling for the day because she'd eaten too much, and I'll just read that last paragraph and jump in there. Still, none of our good eating prepared me for Fisher's Baslow Hall. Within this elegant stone manor house in a sunlit bower where painted birds and plants crept up the wallpaper, each exquisitely presented dish was paired with an unusual yet perfect wine by sommelier Matt Davison. I had known that this sort of lunch would be incompatible with a full day of cycling. I had not realized how the afternoon would flow past in a haze until we were too late to visit Chatsworth, despite its being just 3 miles away. Bess of Hardwick, I feel, would not have approved. But then, even with all her wealth,
modern world does have a few things.
Fortunately, Chatsworth was still there the following day. Back in our car, we rounded a bend past Edensor Village to be confronted by a vast structure of golden sandstone surrounded by more than 100 acres of gardens, including the first Duke's Fountain, where each of the steps varied to alter the sound of the falling water. And the labyrinth that replaced Paxton's conservatory, which was so expensive to maintain that it was deliberately blown up after World War I. The treasures were dazzling. A gigantic fountain built to wow Tsar Nicholas of Russia on his planned visit, and the beautiful malachite urns he sent as an apology for not showing up. Dizzying ceiling murals, the magnificently detailed Devonshire hunting tapestries. At one point, I trotted swiftly through a small room and had to reverse sharply. Amid various animal drawings, I spotted a Rembrandt. 16 generations of Cavendishes have lived at Chatsworth, but I couldn't detect Bess, who married into the Cavendish family in 1547, anywhere, perhaps because the house she built was pulled down and replaced with its 175-room one. Nor was she discernible in Endesor Chapel, despite its ornate memorial to two of her sons. I walked up the graveyard slope, past Paxton's tomb, to pay my respects to Kathleen Kennedy Cavendish, who married the tenth Duke's heir and died in a plane crash in 1948. A plaque commemorated her brother JFK's visit in 1963, just months before he was assassinated. I finally found Bess, or at least her charismatic ghost, at Hardwick Hall, described as more glass than wall because of the size and number of its windows. Beneath a roof that displayed Bess's initials on every turret, I walked the 167-foot-long gallery, thinking about the determination required to use so much of one of Elizabethan England's most expensive building materials, and the hard-headedness with which she judged her son-in-law's glassworks to be problematic. Eventually, she set up her own. If she'd lived a century later, she could probably have startled the Industrial Revolution on her. Like quietly bubbling St. Anne's Well, she is easy to overlook. Yet, in their different ways, the warm underground spring and the fiery countess powered the story of Derbyshire, the little-known English county that helped create the modern. And a few little notes here, our favorite things. Nothing beats the crispy batter served with a heap of perfectly salted chips at Beale's, B-E-A-L. And it's in the Welsh seaside town of Porthcawl. Get a takeaway box and enjoy it while you sit and watch surfers brave the Bristol. Among the peaks, says Nina Kaplan, where to stay? Buxton Crescent, a feat of restoration that took nearly 20 years, has resulted in a luxurious hotel with curved corridors and a much upgraded spa that would have made the 1789 building's progenitor, the 5th Duke of Devonshire, proud. As from ensanahotels.com, doubles from 166. Where to eat? The Cow. Cornish fish and Devonshire meat, including fine pork crackling, an English pub specialty, making a winning combination at this well-designed Dalbury gastropub with rooms. Cowdalbury, LBURY.com, entrees 13 to 37. The Devonshire Arms at Pilsley. The influence of the Duke's family means there are three pubs with this name, all serving good beer, hearty food, and cream teas. This one, which also has rooms, is actually on the Chatsworth estate. It's devonshirehotels.co.uk, entree 17 to Fisher's Baslow Hall, a stunning restaurant in an old stone manor in Baslow that's now a hotel. The menu features inventive dishes, such as barbecued kingfish paired with sake. Unmissable. And that's fixed prices from $55. Pack Horse Inn. Little Longstone is a gorgeous village with a pub to match. The Packhorse has flagstone floors, delicious food, and better Bakewell pudding, which is a jam and almond sponge not to be confused with Bakewell tart, than anywhere in nearby Bakewell. That's quite a praise. And that's the Packhorse Longstone. And it's entrees 14 to 21. And finally, underwear to eat, Stella's Kitchen. A brilliant Stella Kizaab, originally from Cameroon, plates up terrific Afro-Caribbean curries in her EM front garden, while a Haitian black cockerel stalks past your feet. And that's a dinner buffet for $34. What to do? Chatsworth House. Tour the magnificent 170-bedroom home of the Duke of Devonshire, set in beautiful gardens on a vast estate. Hardwick Hall, the house Bess of Hardwick built next to her birthplace. Hardwick is less astounding than Chatsworth, but much more approachable. It's part of the National Trust. Live for the hills. Mark and Jackie Sweeney offer bespoke walks in the Peak District that range from Pride and Prejudice tours, part of the Keira Knightley film was made, to visits to historic villages. News, and that's liveforthehills.com. Museum of Making.
an enormous, innovative museum and workshop in Derby that opened in May 2021 in a former silk mill that is thought to be the world's first factory. DerbyMuseums.org. Peak District National Park, one of England's largest and most beautiful parks between the industrial cities of Manchester and Sheffield. peakdistrict.gov.uk. And how to book. For a thorough tour of Derbyshire, including stately homes with stunning gardens like Chatsworth, contact TNL A-lister advisor Ellen LeCompte. And that's spelled L-E-C-O-M-E. And it's Ellen at LeCompteTravel.com. And let's not forget to talk about some of these photographs. The first is the thermal pool at the Hotel Buxton Crescent. And it is a deep blue rather than that bright aqua blue and has a very... Here's a person, Higger Tor. It's a rocky outcrop near Hathersage in Peak District National Park. And there's a person standing above this rocky mound. It reminds me a little bit of Elephant Rocks or maybe the Garden of the Gods, those soft, rounded stones that seem to be toppled on top of one another. But he's standing out looking over all the fields in this part of the country, and they're squared off with hedgerows, perhaps, or maybe some stone walls. The ground is rolling. It's not terribly flat, but it's also... Here's a close-up of a sheep at Winnett's Pass in the Peak District National Park, and there are outcroppings of stone and stone walls, and we see people just walking about this very large space, and the sheep are mixed among them. It's very green, too. Here's a photograph of the Buxton Opera House, and it's quite opulent. The stone is a kind of a tan brick and then matching stone, a huge arched window and balcony above the front door, which is a stained dark wood. There are turrets on either side, domes, I should say, and they look as if they are covered in perhaps copper, with ridges all around, round domes and windows in that story as well, columns in between the windows, all made out of this same tan stone. And above the sign, Opera House, is a statue, a structure of two, looks like Pan is on the right, because he's seated playing a kind of a flute, and doesn't have a lot of clothes on, he seems to be draped with a cloth. And the other side, I'm not sure what character that would be, but the two characters sit atop this area above this arched entryway. And on this, the overhanging marquee, it says Opera House, upper circle, dress circle and stalls, private boxes. A photograph of a white peach shoe pastry hall. It's, I'm not sure what this wafer on top of it is. It looks like it could be white chocolate with some pink running through it, perhaps some peach. But the shoe itself is really golden. And here's a dining room at Fisher's, and it's beautifully appointed. White linen tablecloths, chairs that are upholstered in a kind of a beige linen. But what I'm struck by is the gorgeous wallpaper. Flowering print that covers everything, very winding. Maybe a sort of a stylized Jacobean print, but very flowing. And then on top of that, yet another lithograph, perhaps framed lithograph of a bunch of flowers in a vase. Here's a photograph of Hardwick Hall. That was the one built by Bess in the 16th century. Lots of windows, as they said, unusual for that time. They're mullioned windows, and they're all of the same rectangular shape. They look to be three across by four down, and three stories of that. But we're looking through a hedge on either side and a long stretch of grass there. Feel as if I've seen a movie. Pride and Prejudice of people walking down this kind of alley of green grass and green hedges on either side. And that concludes our part on the destination of the year, the UK. And so now we're going to jump into the experiences section of the magazine. And the first photograph is of someone cross-country skiing in Andorra. It's a mountainous island in Norway's far north. And it's mountainous indeed and snow-covered. The green
pine trees are peeking through the snow, but we can see what looks to be a ski run, or maybe a fire line in the on the mountain that is free of trees. But there are some people on flatter land below this, and they're cross-country skiing. And so we begin. Wide winter skies. The Arctic landscapes of northern Norway make for a singular snow-cloaked adventure. Heini Bakkeid revisits the fjords and forests that shaped him, while foraging new paths, personal and otherwise. Heini, H-E-I-N-E, and the last name is B-A-K-K-E-I-D. When I tell people that writing is my life, I really mean it. The process consumes me, especially during the winter months when I rarely see anyone outside my family. My mystery novels tend to be on the darker side of the Nordic noir genre. Their protagonist, the troubled former police officer Thorkild Aske, is a completely broken man. Each new installment takes quite a toll on me. Still, I am always giddy starting on the next project. In some ways, the beginning always feels like an adventure, never really knowing what awaits around the next bend, over the next hill. In February of 2021, I delivered my latest manuscript, Saint Avenger, to my editors. I had spent almost 2 years on it, 2 years researching, writing, and trying to understand the people on both sides of the line between good and evil. By the time I had finished, I desperately needed to clear my head. Usually I would go traveling, find some place to reset, enjoy some good food, have an adventure out in the world. But this time there was a pandemic going on. My options were limited. Map of Norway. Oslo is at the very long, skinny country. The Arctic Circle is about midway through it. And then above that are the towns of Hinoya, Andorra, and Tromsø. The Norwegian flag flies over the Harstad Harbor. It's a close-up of the Norwegian flag. Didn't know orange, perhaps, or maybe it's a faded red. And then we have a winter view of the Harstad waterfront. And we can see why painted in bright colors with all that bleak landscape throughout the winter. The homes are red and white. There are some that are a lot of glass,
this hotel.
But they are perched on the hillside, rising up out of the harbor. And there's a sailboat.
Yeah.
Sails are down, but it must be a warm day. There's no sight of sun. He continues, I live on the island of Hinoya, just outside the town of Harstad in northern Norway, a land of mountains and sea and some forest in between. The vastness of the place reminds me of my childhood in nearby Belnes, an Arctic village made up of only 5 houses. As a kid, I often went on adventures on my own, by the shore, in the woods, or up on the mountain plateau, leaving the world behind. After finishing the new book, I decided it was time to do it again, to reacquaint myself with the open spaces of my childhood, and to once again let them engulf me. I began by making a reservation at Rokkenes Gard, a farmstead that's been run by the same family, to learn more about the history of the land I grew up on. The estate is located just outside Harstad, on the bay of Bergsvagen. This area was cleared for agriculture as early as the 4th century AD, and was in use throughout Viking times and the Middle Ages. It's now home to an acclaimed hotel and restaurant, but ingredients still come from the rich farmland nearby
and the sea.
According to owner Christian Frederik Kulseng, the food philosophy at Rokkenes combines traditional recipes with seasonal sourcing. I ate crisp pan-fried cod from Meyer in the Vesterålen archipelago, accompanied by a carrot shredded cabbage sautéed with butter and home-smoked bacon. Baked small red potatoes from the island of Gritoya, and a kefir panna cotta with local berries. While dining, I looked out over the fjords, the mountains, and the islands of Rola and Andorra to the east. Suddenly, I got a glimpse of myself as a kid, watching my grandfather working outside while my grandmother fried cod at the stove. My parents were only teenagers when I was born. Young love, right? And for a time, we lived on Rolla with my 2 grandparents. My uncle still lives in that house, and our family has a summer home near there. But after Rokkenes, I decided to visit the neighboring island, Andorra, just a ferry ride away. It's also connected to Rolla by an underwater tunnel. Andorra is Northern Europe's most mountainous island. Its tallest peak, Linden rises 4,200 feet above sea level. A winter storm was brewing even before I left for Amgenes, a fishing village on Andorra's northwestern corner. But I was impatient for the nighttime silence, the wilderness, the cold metal of the winter sky. I'd contacted Andorra Adventures, a tour operator that can also help visitors rent a robu, one of the seasonal fishermen's cabins that line the Norwegian coast, now popular as holiday homes. The company has a long track record of setting up more extreme activities, like fjord fishing and whale safaris. I wanted to go cross-country night skiing, but before heading to the mountains, I was excited to see a new project from Andorra Adventures founder Terje Hansen, the Arctic Shark Center, which is set to become one of the region's most spectacular tourism initiatives. A scientific facility built in collaboration with the University of Tromsø, Arctic University of Norway, the center was designed to attract visitors with a combination of ecology, architecture, and local food and drink. Its buildings draw their form from the shape and movement of the Greenland shark, which is native to these waters. One structure, nicknamed Haihuset, or the shark house, meanders toward the open sea. The other, Parasitten, or the parasite, mimics the shape of an organism that lives in the eyes of almost all Greenland sharks. The complex is also home to four Robuer, which will be replaced by a luxury hotel and restaurant just feet from where the sea comes crashing in. DNA research takes place in the shark house, where I met Professor Kim Preble, who gave me a tour of the operations. After we watched a live stream of images and sounds from 1,600 feet below the surface of the fjord, Preble explained a pioneering technique called meta-barcoding, which the university uses to assess marine biodiversity. It allows us to find the DNA signature of every creature living in a specific part of the ocean, using only 3 half-liter samples of water, he explained. We can count the number of organisms in that area without even going out in a boat. Let's say we were at a crime scene, Professor, I wondered aloud. Could the police vacuum a room and find DNA the same way? Perhaps I had found material for my next novel. Through the window, all we could see was a weak glimmer way out in the fjord, where skeletal beams of moonlight broke through the clouds to illuminate the surface of the earth. After waving goodbye to the professor, I packed my rucksack and drove a couple of miles into the forest to don my ski gear. The rain had compressed the snow, so the cross-country trails were perfect, even for my wax-free skis. The wind was still howling, but as soon as I got away from the ocean and into the trees, the dying storm manifested as little more than a squeaking whisper between the branches. It was so dark I put on a headlamp. No northern lights, no stars or moon, just inkiness all around me. After about an hour of skiing, I set up a gappa hook, a traditional wooden lean-to used for camping and fishing, and began to make a fire. I'd had a lunch of hearty bread, ham, and sausage with whole peppercorns. Now I unwrapped my dinner, meatballs, fried potatoes, and root vegetables in foil for cooking on the fire. For dessert, fresh-baked cookies and dark roast bonfire coffee. The storm clouds were breaking up. The dying fire eventually burned out. For a short while, everything was completely dark. Then suddenly, I was surrounded by moonlight, an amazing metallic aura with shades of black and blue that illuminated the sky, the trees, the mountains, and snow. The feeling came rushing through my body all at once. I'd been longing for the wide-open spaces of my childhood, but looking into the forest, it struck me that a wide-open space also existed between me and my younger self. Time only expands outward, never looking back. I couldn't reset the clock, only acknowledge it, accept it, and maybe get a quick glimpse of that kid again, out here in this forest. And we have a slice of northern Norway, Andorra Adventures, fishing trips, boat, and Rorbu rentals, and activities like hiking and skiing have been this tour operator's domain for more than 25 years. And it's Andorra, and that's J-A at the end, hyphen Adventures. Arctic Shark Center, the founder of Andorra Adventures, collaborated with the Arctic University of Norway on this combination research station, citizen science base, hotel, and restaurant, all slated to open to the public by late 2023 and early 2024. ArcticShockCenter.com. Refsnes Matglade. Apologies, folks, I don't know Norwegian. RefsnesMatglede. For a day of exploring Hinoya, pick up provisions at this specialty food store in Bokennes, west of Harstad, which spotlights local ingredients. We have Rokennes Gard. This inn on a historic farmstead also has a popular restaurant, reservation strongly encouraged, that sources from the fertile countryside around Harstad. And it's Rokennesgaa. Doubles from 147, tasting menus. And how to book, you can go to his top travel advisors, Melissa Lee. She can create a Northern Norway itinerary that incorporates ski resorts, Arctic villages, and remote islands like the Lofoten Archipelago. And some photographs. Here is one of a storm blowing in over the Gullsfjorden. And it's quite large. A lot of white caps and white froth up against shoreline. Some trees blowing. You can tell they're leaning somewhat. And mountains rising back in the distance that are covered. Here's a building at the Arctic Shark Center. And I wonder if this is one of those rubus. It's a very, it looks like a one of those container buildings, or, you know, that you find on the back of trucks and on railroads, those containers. But the difference is very large glass windows overlooking the water on all sides. A close-up of some cross-country skis, red skis and navy blue pants, and they're all buttoned up and tight there. Here's a photograph of Arbostatinden. It's one of the many peaks on Andorra, the top 3,000. But I can see a farm, perhaps, or some kind of a couple of buildings. Hardy souls to live in places like that. And now for a very different part of the world under the experiences is the Javanese Jewel. As Indonesia opens to visitors again, Kayla Stewart returns to the island where she lived years ago and remembers why the enchanting, energetic Yogyakarta region is an essential photograph here. It's a reading nook in the Dalem Jiwo suite at Aman Jiwo. It's a secluded resort in central Java. And we see it is open air, but there's a huge cushioned, tufted, to be like a bed, actually, with pillows all around. But on top of it is a tray with backgammon game. And another tray stacked with large kind of coffee table books. And there's some fruit stacked there and beautiful stone columns. And it looks as if, I can't tell, but it looks as if those rounded, you know, supporting a rounded dome, perhaps, roof type. And we begin. When people think of Indonesia, they often picture Bali and its picturesque beaches. But as I sat aboard a train on the neighboring island of Java, passing rice terraces, ancient temples, and glorious expanses of forest overlooked by towering mountains, I wondered, why not here, too? Java is home to more than 140 million people, making it the world's most popular. In 2016, I spent a year living in the province of Central Java, where I taught English at a military boarding school in Semarang, a port city on the northern coast. During my time there, I fell in love with Java's national parks, ancient temples, and dynamic cities, and I returned for the first time this past August, seeking to reconnect. Here, street food is culture, and culture is king. It seemed only right that I would begin my return trip on the hunt for Jajan Pasar, the traditional Javanese cakes, so delightful they've become synonymous with the city. My friend, the Indonesian food scholar Kevindra Priyanto Soemantri, explained that the sweets come in a range of colors but are usually made from a four-ingredient foundation: cassava, palm sugar, coconut, and sticky rice or rice flour. Mba Satinem's food stall, Lupis Mba Satinem, in the Jettis district, is known as one of the best places to enjoy Jajan Pasar. The elder has been making the cakes for more than 50 years, charming visitors with her confectionery intellect. On Somantri's recommendation, Satinem appeared in the Netflix series Street Food Asia. The sweets are just one example of how food permeates the streets of Jogja, where satay, gudeg, fruit, and kopi joss, which is coffee with charcoal, take center stage. There was even food growing on the roof of my hotel, cabbage, spinach, mint, and basil, among other herbs and leafy greens. During my stay at Green Host Boutique Hotel, with doubles from $57, in the popular Prawiro Taman area, I chatted with assistant manager Pak Surya, who told me all about the goal of providing affordable accommodation that was also eco-conscious. "We figured out how to naturally cool the building," Surya said as we stood by the pool in the atrium, surrounded by towering greenery. He pointed up to the garden above, which was releasing mist into the atrium. "In a country that's battled pollution, deforestation, and other environmental challenges, it was a lush sign of promise." The sense of invention runs deep within the Earth's artistic community, too. The Jogja National Museum provides a stage for contemporary artists from Java and other Indonesian islands with rotating exhibitions and performances, and even opened its own guest house, Casa Wirabrajan, during the pandemic. In the nearby city of Magelang, the OHD Museum is a lesson in cultural reclamation. It displays the acquisitions of private collector Oe Hong Dijin, known for gathering modern and contemporary Indonesian art from around the world, including pieces by pioneers like Raden Saleh and Ahmad Sadali, and bringing it back home. I was in Jogja during Art Jog, a contemporary art fair, where highlights included Catalan Pinggir Jurang, a dreamlike pillow installation by Alex Abad and Angki Pur Bandano, and Borobudur, Expanding on Awareness, which is a dark room with neon-bright renderings of Buddhist statues and temple-goers. The latter was put together by Nawa Tunggal and his brother, the painter Dwi Putro, whose work draws on his experience with schizophrenia. Later, visiting the Hindu temple complex at Prambanan, just outside the city, I saw the ancient stone reliefs in a new way. Jogja's creative streak was on full display at Meal's Kitchen, and that's entrees $5 to $12, where chef Nili Hendratno combines his global culinary experience, including a stint with Kempinski Hotels, with an unabashed focus on Indonesian produce and flavors. Slices of Wagyu pastrami were bathed in sambal-spiked mayonnaise and pressed against gently toasted focaccia. Gohu Ikan Jendar, a ceviche inspired by the eastern Indonesian island of Ternate, was paired with crispy rice chips. Wagyu cheeks with bone marrow delivered on both presentation and flavor. Plated on a bed of multicolored rocks, the smoky dish was dotted with a rich coffee miso reduction and topped with a bright lime, pickle, and shallot glaze. "Indonesia has the most incredible flavors, the most incredible way of doing things," Hendratno told me. "I'm trying to showcase the range of our technique and of what we can do in the kitchen." The five-course meal was exceptional fuel for the remaining action-filled days of my trip when I headed out of the city to Amanjiwo, doubles from 880, a 31-suite resort in the hills an hour northwest of Jogja. My friend Anna Grunstrom also happened to be in Java on a journey to reconnect with her Indonesian heritage, and we met up for a few Aman-coordinated tours in the more rural parts of the region. It was a comfortable hour-long taxi ride from the city to what is, for many visitors, the main event, Borobudur, a UNESCO World Heritage Site containing the world's largest Buddhist temple, likely opened in the 9th century and restored in the 20th. It's also one of Indonesia's most visited tourists. "It took about 100 years to build," our guide Hasan Bisri told us. "When you see Borobudur from a helicopter, it looks like a lotus." Visitors were once able to walk through the temple's 9 stacked platforms, which hold stunning Buddhist statues and numerous relief panels. But graffiti and physical damage, as well as the ongoing pandemic, have restricted guides to showing guests around the ground level. Nonetheless, Bisri, who has worked at the temple since 1988, was thrilled to once again be giving tours to international. Anna, who was visiting Indonesia for the first time, was in awe. "I was transported 5 years earlier, when I'd watched the sun rise over a row of life-size booths. Much is different in my life now. Relationships have evolved, homes have changed, the world is somehow even more complicated. But my feelings about Borobudur have remained the same. This marvel, constructed from lava rock from a nearby volcano, is a testament to and a portrait of a society trying to figure it all out. I imagine the people of the 8th and 9th centuries turning to the teachings of Buddhism and Hinduism to navigate their own challenges, many of which we're still navigating. Amid their struggles, they managed to live, thrive, and create something beautiful. It's what humans have been doing forever, and what we'll continue to do, even in our seemingly darkest days. Amanjiwo overlooks the most stunning ruins of Borobudur, its suites nestled on a hill in a remote area of central Java. I have no qualms about admitting my sybaritic inclinations, and the resort had no qualms indulging them. I was greeted by flower-throwing employees who offered me a refreshing bowl of watermelon before walking me to my high-ceilinged suite, which opened out onto a private garden. After enjoying my plush room for a few hours, the Aman arranged a visit to the home of Chef Pak Bilal, whose son, Pak Damar, now runs the show. Against a backdrop of gamelan music, Damar prepared a sumptuous, comforting-tasting menu that left me speechless. Prawns in a steaming bowl of soup with wood ear mushrooms, grilled chicken marinated in cilantro and lemongrass, a Javanese fish curry, grilled tofu wrapped in banana leaves. The culinary performance ended with Damar's own selection of jajan pasar, including dadar gulung, a crepe-like pastry flavored with pandan leaf and stuffed with caramelized coconut. Normal people, people with common sense, would go back to their luxury hotel room, grab a book from the nightstand, and slowly settle into their upper thousands thread count sheets. I, however, opted to see more of this massive island, even if it meant a possible bout of hypothermia. Anna, who was staying in a guest house nearby, met me at 10 p.m. for a three-hour drive to the base of Central Java's Mount Prau, or Prau, P-R-A-U, one of Indonesia's many volcanoes. The dormant peak stretches to 8,415 feet above sea level. After a cold, hours-long hike through the Dieng Plateau, wondrous views awaited us. At the summit, Anna and I snuggled into a tent while our guide, Pak Hariyadi, and two assistants prepared piping hot noodles and tea. As the light began to emerge, we stood in the windy expanse and watched the sun rise over the earth. It was entrancing. I felt I could almost reach out and grab the nearest cloud, or touch the other, even taller volcanoes nearby. We lingered, grappling our world, and then made our way back down. At the resort that evening, Anna joined me for a staging of the Ramayana, an epic poem that emerged in Java in the 8th or 9th century and is still performed throughout Indonesia. The private performance was accompanied by delicacies like udang, bakar, kalasan, grilled prawns marinated in local coconut milk. We devoured every dish as with indisputable passion. A lot of people come to Indonesia to engage with spiritualism and mysticism, Aman's resident anthropologist, Patrick Van Hobrook, had told me over tea the previous day. They go straight to Bali to look for this, not realizing that the heart of it is right here on Java. Enjoying one last swim before heading to the airport, pausing after a few laps in the infinity pool to take in the surroundings, I felt like I was it. And the central market in Jogja's historic Kota Gede neighborhood, and we see it's a long rectangular space. I don't know. It looks like I can probably see at least 50 feet here. And very, very colorful with all different colored fruits piled high on either side, and also a middle aisle where we see buckets full of, I think perhaps I'm seeing some seafood in there, but also vegetables piled high, bright bowls, and women with aprons on one side dishing it out, or perhaps cooking as well. Scarves on their heads, and everyone wearing a mask. There's kind of a roof over this market, so it's out of the elements, I suppose, but still a lot of light, and I imagine some rain could come in. It's not really a permanent-looking structure. This is a photograph. I don't know where to begin. It's a 9th-century buildings at Prambanan, the largest Hindu temple complex in Indonesia. It's made out of all stone, kind of a grayish tan stone. But how do I do this? It reminds me of when you're on the beach and you take wet sand and drip it from your fingers, and it piles up. in globs that are quite decorative. Lots of tiny little domes featured all up the sides, rooftops, and each one with its own individual. So very, very ornate, and yet there is absolutely no color other than the stone. It's pretty cool. Here's a photograph of the atrium at Green Host Boutique Hotel, and it looks to be made completely of concrete. Just a very simple structure of a building, or very simple material, but it's a three-sided courtyard here, or atrium, excuse me, pool at the bottom with tables around it. And then I'm seeing three stories. I don't know if it goes any higher than that, but each one of them, the balcony guardrail, is laden with greenery, so that you're looking up at greenery all around this stark gray cement. Naturally, we've got a photograph of some food, and here is Jajan Pasar, which was mentioned a few times. It's often served on a banana leaf, and it is served in a banana leaf here. It's a market treat, and I guess it's sort of like takeout food. You can put it in a banana leaf and eat it as you shop. Something pink? I don't know if that'd be a pickled vegetable, or maybe it's a seafood that's been soaked in something pink. Coconut, for sure, kind of dribbled all over everything, and something very dark, black, something yellow, and then something kind of caramel-colored. And, oh my, the rice terraces surrounding Selo Griyo. That's a small Hindu temple between Jogja and Semarang. We don't see the temple, but we see these beautiful rice terraces, meticulously cared for. The ones in the forefront have no greenery on them. They're too large for a human to just take a step up. There needs to be a staircase alongside them. But nothing's growing there right yet, and it's planting season there. But beyond that, we see on another hillside, the green terrace is fully green and with some kind of growth. It could be rice. It looks like some sort of a grass or grain. And then lots of trees. They're not afraid to keep some of their space for trees and not devote it all to the agriculture. And way in the distance we see a flatter area that's planted. And finally, the sun rises over the 9th century Buddhist temple at Borobudur. And I think we're on the top of this temple because those little, as I said before, you get these little domes just sprinkled all over the building. And that's what we're standing among here. I would guess they were feet tall and on this ceiling, and then we're looking out over several walls of the building. And the sun is pretty well risen. The sky is blue, green trees. And that concludes that lovely article. Our next experience is entitled A New Direction. For Marcia De Sanctis, A Midlife Pivot opened up a world of adventure and fulfillment. No photographs here, but some illustrations. And the first one is of a woman in a purple shirt sitting at her desk, writing in a journal as paper airplanes. Abandon. This is the word we carry when we arrive somewhere else, to give ourselves over without restraint. It is a singular thrill to pitch out of the satisfying but predictable order of domestic life and into this state of disarray. We become vagabonds, searchers, giddy tourists. How strange and wonderful it is to stash only the essentials into a bag and shut the door behind us. We lift off. We land somewhere across the world, sometimes alone. What exactly has been left behind? And what might lead us back? Every arrival is a crash course in possibility. But being somewhere new does not always open a path to a meeting. Waiting for a bus under a battering sun, or breathing the bug spray on a hotel pillow. We crave the safety of our old couch, the comfort of friends and family. But for me, comfort never endures. Restlessness prickles under my skin. Traveling alone and writing about it is my work, a career I began at 50. It was a discovery at midlife, one that exposed both the escape and the adventure I craved as I confronted my life's second half. One that reached back to the most elemental part of me, the younger woman I once was, the child I had been. In third grade, as soon as my mother allowed me to walk to the center of Winchester, Massachusetts, along a half mile of flat suburban streets, I was always wanting to go alone. "Why don't you ask a friend to walk with you?" my mother would ask. But I didn't want a friend, not then and not now. I preferred to drift unaccompanied, unencumbered, and I grew intimate with my own independence. Even then, I think I understood the restorative power, the joyous exuberance of these stretches of time spent alone. In my 20s and 30s, I traveled for my work as a television journalist, for weddings, for the heck of it, and then I stopped. I gave up my career as a producer and media executive and moved with my husband and two young children to a rural New England town. During the next several years, I barely set foot on a plane. It was as if this phase of life erected a tough membrane I could not cross. During this time, home was where I belonged, where I needed to be. 5 years of dislocation later, I was in my mid-40s, the land of reckoning. Middle age was less an ebb and flow than a relentless. "Your children are all that matter," is the bromide foisted upon every woman as soon as she gives birth, a vague notion about the primacy of mothering above all else that is deeply embedded into our collective consciousness. But if my children were everything that mattered, what then was I? The easiest and most satisfying way I could grapple with the crisis, the tsunamic love for my children that coexisted with my abundant sense of failure, was to try to be productive. In the daylight hours, I pecked out a novel from the driver's seat of my car during the kids' piano lessons. It never sold. I taught French. Finally, I enrolled in a master's program in international relations. From the opening words of the first macroeconomics lecture, I was inspired in a way I had not been in decades. Through my course in politics, trade, and humanitarian studies, the world had shown itself to me again. After graduation, I could not find a job in policy or development. I knocked on doors in Washington, D.C., and if anyone bothered to open one, it was only to slam it shut again. Under the delusion that I could jump into a job as Chief of Staff to the Secretary General of the United Nations or as National Security Advisor to newly elected President Obama, I was left with a shattered ego and a school loan that I needed to pay back. Dispirited, unemployed, on the cusp of 50, I sought a plan. What I found was a voice. Ideas began to pile up for essays and stories. I wrote them, and one after another, I sent them out to editors. There were many rejections, then fewer, which felt like the beginning of something. I began to travel again. I found myself in airports on my way somewhere, seeking an awakening and a story, gathering pearls for a necklace. On I went, scouring the planet for windows with infinite views. Once in a while, I would turn my lens back on myself and find meaning, self-knowledge, and ultimately, a way home. I leveraged everything I could to invest in my new career. I cashed in my 401k. I sold a watch, maxed out a credit card, and asked my sisters for help. I booked one ticket and then another, always in pursuit of a story. Now and always, travel imparts a liquid language whose sole property is the flow of questions. Where will I find a pearl? Since my first major magazine story was published in my 50th year, I have written about 140 more. It is in travel writing that I find kernels of truth about the creative process, love, memory, purpose, devotion, aging. I am fortunate to have both a home to return to and work that allows me to travel, and when I do, I fully and gratefully grasp my privilege. A person who can measure life in journeys taken is lucky indeed. But there are enticing mysteries everywhere, even within the four walls of my house. The world is full of them. It's possible that such an existence of comings and goings, of departure longing lounges and arrival gates, will become increasingly rare and potentially more fraught. Burgeoning refugee crises caused by poverty and climate change are causing mass relocation, exposing the inequality between those who travel by plane, because they wish to, and those who travel on foot, because their survival depends on it. The COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated humanity's existential worries and solidified a shared sense of paralysis. In addition, it has shined a light on what we've known for a long time, that travel can be risky, a vector for deadly contagions, and that it often exploits local populations and the global ecosystem. From carbon emissions to sunscreen residue on the planet's coral reefs, our need to get away can be seen as selfish, unnecessary, and harmful. And yet, we as a species are designed to wander, to venture beyond our own valley into another, to cross oceans and mountain ranges. Whether we seek adventure, connection, beauty, solitude, togetherness, or nothing less than the meaning of life, travel is ultimately about human curiosity. Like love, curiosity is an engine that can change fate and move the tides. When we cast ourselves off from customary moorings and expose ourselves to other landscapes and people, we become empathetic, hopeful, worthy citizens. For now, I will keep going, resolved to travel quietly and lightly, to listen, to observe, to be open to the grace of the universe, to awe and sublimity. But I will always take the familiar path home. And this is an introduction from A Hard Place to Leave, permission from Traveler's Tales. And that's a copyright 2022, again by Marcia. Next under Experiences, Mountain Spirits. Amid the Himalayan peaks of Ladakh, in India's far north, the once-threatened snow leopard is thriving. Prasad Ramamurti sets out on their trail and reports on the delicate truce between the animals and their human neighbors. And these photographs are by Himanshu Lakwa. Get in the car, quick, shouted our guide, to Changwa Norbu, just as his crew had begun setting up a tailgate picnic. He came running down the hillside, a cloud of dust in his wake, and in less than a minute, our equipment was loaded, hot tea reluctantly wasted, car doors slammed, and then we were hurling downhill at breakneck speed. That the road, or what passes for it, bordered a sheer cliff seemed immaterial. Slow down, Norbu said to the driver as we approached a bend, beyond which the road jumping out, he ran forward and trained his binoculars on a distant ridge. When he turned back to our vehicle, his face was wearing. For nearly a week, we'd been tracking the snow leopard in and around the village of Ule in western Ladakh, India's northernmost province, one of very few accessible regions where visitors stand a decent chance of spotting this elusive and endangered big cat. We'd trekked up slopes of loose shale following footprints, crouched in wait along grassy ridges, and braved winds that seemed considerably colder than the feels-like reading on our weather apps. We had seen two varieties of wild sheep, ibex, Himalayan wolves, multiple bird species, and a lone red fox. But the snow leopard, known in the region as the Gray Ghost, had eluded us. Until now. Look over there, Norbu said, pointing to the top of a hill nearly half a mile away. I don't see anything, I replied. As if in response, a snow leopard revealed herself, stretching in the classic cat yoga pose, shaking off the dust and cold of the night and basking in the warmth of the morning sun. Even at a distance, I could tell she was a beauty. Her coat, which she was giving a good lick, was a grayish beige, her rosette markings dark against the pale black background. Her tail, which she flicked every now and then, was long and thick. With her were three cubs, one of which was attempting to play with its siblings. They refused to stir. The mother lowered her head, allowing her baby to climb onto her back, then fall off. Suddenly, she stopped, sat up, and looked straight in our direction. Word of the sighting had spread, and eager safari-goers and other residents of the Snow Leopard Lodge, the homestay Norbu owns, had arrived, leaving a cloud of dust behind them that could be seen from miles around. February is right in the middle of peak tourist season, so company was to be expected, though in this remote region, feels like a crowd. Nonetheless, all this human activity seemed to have caught the mother's attention. We were told to quiet down, lest she decide to leave. Sitting on her haunches, she watched us. The feels-like 10 degrees Celsius wind found its way through my thermals as a flock of shukar partridges fluttered in a tree below. The wild sheep on the hillside above grazed unperturbed. Finally, Lady Leopard decided we posed no danger after all, and lay down for a snooze. We heaved a collective sigh of relief. I told you wouldn't leave without seeing the Shan, Norbu said with a smile, using the Ladakhi word for snow leopard. I smiled back. Western Ladakh is mostly barren, its mountains stark and shale-covered. Spotting a snow leopard, or any animal for that matter, is like finding the proverbial proverbial needle in a haystack. But Nabu, who has been guiding visitors since 2004, is something of a legend when it comes to tracking these creatures. He is a favorite of photographers, documentary filmmakers, and conservationists. "To me, the Shan is like the Dalai Lama of wildlife," he declared one day as we camped in the backyard of the Snow Leopard Lodge, scanning the neighboring hill for signs of the animal. "It's the most powerful creature here. Don't we always look up to the powerful?" The relationship between man and apex predator hasn't always been this respectful. Nabu explained that as a child, he learned to track snow leopards from his grandfather and father, both formidable hunters who would seek revenge when the cats killed their cattle. Historically, snow leopards were also killed for their pelts and body parts, which were used in traditional medicine. In Ladakh, conservation for the species got a boost in 2002 when the Snow Leopard Conservancy India Trust, a much-lauded agency of Ladakh and Spiti, introduced homestays in areas where human-animal conflict was a persistent problem. "The homestays are the single most important contribution to conservation," said Dr. Swang Nangali, director of the CLCIT. "Until they arrived, trekkers and safari-goers would mostly camp outdoors. Often, they would leave garbage behind. Locals suggested that if visitors stayed with them, it could generate revenue and reduce stress on the environment." In those days, very few tourist dollars were finding their way back into the economy. The SLCIT helped villagers set up more than 200 homestays, including the Snow Leopard Lodge, across the western part of Ladakh, and has trained residents to become trekking guides and naturalists. Nabu runs the lodge with his family and other villagers. So, while the facilities are simple, old-school wood-fired heaters in all the rooms, and hot water that's fetched in buckets, the service is heartfelt. It's also easily the best the region has to offer. That's where we'll have to stop today, folks. There's a little bit left, and we can pick it up when we get back together again next week. And so until then...
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3. Here's what's happening on the Armchair Adventure Hour. Starting Wednesday, January 18th, we continue the Little House series with the fourth book, On the Banks of Plum Creek by Laura Ingalls Wilder. The adventures of Laura and her family continue as they leave their little house on the prairie and travel in their covered wagon to Minnesota. Here, they settle in a little house made of sod beside the banks of beautiful Plum Creek. Soon, Pa builds a wonderful new little house with real glass windows and a hinged door. Laura and her sister Mary go to school, help with the chores, and fish in the creek. At night, everyone listens to the merry music of Pa's fiddle. Misfortunes come in the form of a grasshopper plague and a terrible blizzard, but the Pioneer family works hard together to overcome these troubles. And so continues Laura Ingalls Wilder's beloved story of a pioneer girl and her family. The nine Little House books have been cherished by generations of readers and listeners as both a unique glimpse into America's frontier past and a heartwarming, unforgettable story. On the Banks of Plum Creek by Laura Ingalls Wilder, starting Wednesday, January 18th. The Armchair Adventure Hour, every night at 10, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 45 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-30s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading articles from today's USA Today, Thursday, January 26th, 2023. Starting with the money section, under the money line column, three items. First one, Southwest Airlines one-way tickets on sale for $59. Southwest Airlines is offering one-way tickets for as low as $59 so long as you purchase them by February 2nd for travel between the 14th and May 17th. The airline seems to have recovered from its holiday meltdown, and its CEO, Bob Jordan, has said publicly that the airline is committed to learning from that episode and preventing similar acute reliability issues in the future. The sale includes flights from the mainland to Hawaii and Puerto Rico, as well as Southwest international destinations. Second item, Volvo recalls 2023 vehicles due to brakes. Volvo Cars is recalling